From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This week, Philip Roth's novel, The Human Stain, won this year's Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. On today's Fresh Air, Roth talks about The Human Stain and his earlier books. The Human Stain is about political correctness on campus. It's the final work in a trilogy that also included the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel American Pastoral, about conflict at home during the war in Vietnam, and I Married a Communist, set in the McCarthy era. Also, film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Bridget Jones' Diary. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld defended the crew of an American surveillance plane today, saying the plane was flying straight and level until it was hit by a Chinese fighter jet. Rumsfeld said the Chinese pilot was maneuvering aggressively and put the lives of the 24 American crew members at risk. The secretary said Chinese pilots have repeatedly harassed the American planes.
In recent months, there have been 44 PLA interceptions of U.S. surveillance and reconnaissance flights off the coast of China. Six of these were within 30 feet, two were within 10 feet.
Rumsfeld played audio and videotape of previous occasions when Chinese jets had come dangerously close to American planes. Preparations are being made to welcome the crew to its home base on Whidbey Island, Washington. Crew members will be greeted by their families, dignitaries, and a Navy band. Wendy Kaufman has more.
Commander Richard Marin says the plane carrying crew members will roll directly into the open doors of Hangar Number 6.
They'll open up the doors, the air door on the aircraft that'll come down onto the red carpet, and the crew will then come right into the hangar where the ceremony will begin. It ought to be pretty dramatic, and I think there'll be a lot of eyes in the crowd that aren't going to be dry.
After the families reunite, there will be a relatively brief military welcome home ceremony. It's open to the public, and the Navy expects several thousand people to attend. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Whidbey Island, Washington.
The Bush administration wants air conditioners and heat pumps to be using 20% less electricity by the year 2006. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
Early this week, the Bush administration angered many environmentalists when it proposed to make deep cuts in energy conservation research programs run by the Department of Energy. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham defended the proposal, arguing in part that the programs in question weren't making much progress. Abraham may feel differently about energy conservation regulations aimed at the companies that make air conditioners and heat pumps, however. The Energy Department has now announced that these machines need to be 20% more efficient than they are now, 5 years from now. Energy Secretary Abraham says the change will save energy without hurting low-income groups. The new proposal is a watered-down version of a rule proposed in January by the Clinton administration. It would have forced a 30% reduction in electricity use. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
The bodies of seven American servicemen are on their way home after a solemn repatriation ceremony in Hanoi. The Americans and nine Vietnamese were killed in a helicopter crash on Saturday as they did advance preparation to excavate crash sites for the remains of Americans missing in action during the Vietnam War. The bodies have arrived at Hickam Air Force Base, where they're being met by family members. This is NPR News. A California judge has ordered Ford Motor Company to replace defective ignition devices on about 2 million vehicles in the state. The order was prompted by a class action lawsuit that said the vehicles were prone to stalling. The judge said that Ford concealed the badly made parts from government inspectors. The recall will cost Ford an estimated $300 million. Ford says it will appeal the order. There are similar class action lawsuits pending in other states. The nation's largest nonprofit health maintenance organization, Kaiser Permanente, has settled a class action lawsuit filed on behalf of all disabled persons in California. As part of the settlement, Kaiser has agreed to modify all its health centers in the state. Kenny Goldberg reports from member station KPBS in San Diego.
Plaintiffs in the suit claim that Kaiser discriminated against disabled patients by giving them inadequate care. The complaints included examination rooms that were too small, counters that were too high, and inaccessible restrooms. To settle the case, Kaiser says it will make all of the necessary physical changes to ensure complete access for its disabled members. Kaiser spokesman Tom Debley says money is no object.
We actually have not looked at the cost. This decision was made on the basis that this is the right thing to do at this point in history.
Kaiser has also agreed to develop training programs and a special complaint system for the disabled. The HMO has 6 million members in California. For NPR News, I'm Kenny Goldberg in San Diego.
Businesses have begun cutting inventories to cope with the economic slowdown. The Commerce Department reported today that business inventories fell by 0.2% in February. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, Philip Roth's novel, The Human Stain, won this year's Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. Roth first became known in the late 50s and 60s for writing a new kind of story of Jewish identity. In books like Portnoy's Complaint and Goodbye Columbus, he wrote comically about young Jewish men who were alienated from their culture and family. His Penn Faulkner Award-winning novel, The Human Stain, completed a trilogy that explores personal identity and looks at how larger political and cultural events affect the lives of individuals. The first in the trilogy, American Pastoral, won a Pulitzer Prize. It's about the father of a radical activist opposed to the war in Vietnam. I Married a Communist is set in the McCarthy era. The Human Stain is about life in the age of political correctness. The main character, Coleman Silk, is a classics professor at a small liberal arts college who's forced out after using a word that is misinterpreted as a racial slur. A little later in the story, we learn his secret, which reveals the paradox of his situation. Although everyone believes he is Jewish, he's really a light-skinned African-American who pretended to be Jewish after deciding to pass as a white man. Last year, I asked Roth to read a scene in which Silk remembers the emotional impact of telling his mother that he was going to pass and disassociate himself from his black family.
He was murdering her. You don't have to murder your father. The world will do that for you. There are plenty of forces out to get your father. The world will take care of him, as it had indeed taken care of Mr. Silk. Who there is to murder is the mother. And that's what he saw he was doing to her, the boy who'd been loved as he'd been loved by this woman. Murdering her on behalf of his exhilarating notion of freedom. It would have been much easier without her, but only through this test can he be the man he has chosen to be, unalterably separated from what he was handed at birth, free to struggle at being free like any human being would wish to be free. To get that from life, the alternate destiny, on one's own terms, he must do what must be done. Don't most people want to walk out of the lives they've been handed? But they don't. And that's what makes them them. And this was what was making him him. Throw the punch, do the damage, and forever lock the door. You can't do this to a wonderful mother who loves you unconditionally and has made you happy. You can't inflict this pain and then think you can go back on it. It's so awful that all you can do is live with it. Once you've done a thing like this, you have done so much violence, it can never be undone, which is what Coleman wants.
That's Philip Roth reading from his new novel, The Human Stain. Most of your main characters have been Jewish, and some of them have felt kind of choked by Jewish culture. The idea of writing a character who's African-American trying to pass as Jewish, how did that come to you for the novel?
It's a long process, which is hard for me to recapitulate. And it's hard to remember, especially months after you finished a book, it's hard to remember all the strands that went into the inspiration. However it came to me, I was certainly made nervous by the notion. I wasn't delighted to have had this idea in the beginning.
What was the problem?
What do you think the problem was? I was going to write about a black man. Not only a black man, but I was going to write about a black man who becomes a white man. It was a kind of daunting notion. But one sits down and one applies oneself to it. But it turned out I wasn't as ignorant as I thought I was. And after a while, I hit it. In fact, the very scene I just read, the scene in which Coleman repudiates his mother, this marvelous mother he's had, I think it was in writing that scene that I came to grips with the man. And I'd say the reason I came to grips with him, or how I came to grips with him, was because I ceased defending him. I let the brutality of the act come through. I understood, I myself, as the writer, came to understand the brutality that such a choice entailed. And I think I was able to dramatize fully, vividly, the nature of that brutality by having this scene in which he repudiates his mother's love. And the brutality registers on her, and he sees it registering on her right before his eyes. So he's fully conscious, Coleman, of what he's doing. And as much as this character, I think, has a kind of dignity, I think his dignity arises from the fact that he's never deluded about the price others may pay for what he's doing. And he faces as well the price that he pays. I suppose his dignity or his integrity or even his heroism comes from his consciousness of what he's doing.
Now, the character of Coleman Silk, the African-American professor who's passing as white, is also a victim of political correctness. He calls two students who have never come to class spooks. He says, does anyone know these people? Do they exist? Or are they spooks? And the two students who have never come to class, it turns out, are African-American, which the professor didn't know. And they, in turn, accuse him of racism, of having referred to them with the racial slur of spooks. And as a result of this, he ends up losing his job. Now, your one of the previous books in your trilogy, I Married a Communist, is about how lives are affected by McCarthyism. And I'm wondering if you see political correctness today as a kind of new McCarthyism, is a new ideology of the day, similar to McCarthyism in how actions and motives can often be misinterpreted, how group thinking can blow things out of proportion, how a life can be ruined as a result.
Mm-hmm. I think what joins those two political moments, the McCarthy moment and the present moment, is what Hawthorne called in The Scarlet Letter the persecuting spirit. My book is set in 1998, a great year for the persecuting spirit, if ever there was one. That was the year in which the presidential impeachment took place and everything surrounding it. What interested me about the inquisition on the college campus that does in Coleman Silk was it seemed to me, the more I thought about it, an extension of the general mood of the Inquisition that had sort of begun to run wild in the public life of the country. To be sure, that also was what was going on during the McCarthy era, which I lived through as a college kid.
I Married a Communist, I think it's Nathan Zuckerman who remarks on the ideologies that fill people's heads and undermine their observation of life. Actually, it might be his teacher who says that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you were ever caught up in an ideology, say as a young man, if it ever seemed like intellectual and romantic to you before you saw beyond the ideology.
I don't think I'm an ideological type. I think it's hard for a novelist, a serious novelist who knows what novel writing is about, to be an ideologue, because the writing fiction is founded in observation. And you can't observe through the opaque presence of an ideology. The ideology observes for you. So I think that writers on the whole tend to be anti-ideological, and that to my mind, novels are assaults on generalizations, not endorsements of generalizations.
Have you made, I think the answer to this is going to be yes. have you made,
yeah, I'll say it right now, yes. Yeah.
Have you made observations as a novelist that you feel you were punished or harshly criticized for writing or speaking?
No, not at all. you have to be specific, I think.
Well, I was thinking...
You have something in mind.
I was thinking of your early literature with Portnoy, when people referred to you as a self-hating Jew and stuff.
Oh, right, right. Oh, yes. Well, sure, I thought that those were vicious, malicious, and stupid epithets to attach to me. Just contrary to all the evidence. So, yeah, I felt assaulted by those kind of stupid generalizations. But there's nothing you can do about the stupid generalizations, really. You can feel wounded by them, and you do. And you can fight them, and you do. But in the end, the world grinds these things out the way they make cornflakes at the Kellogg's plant, you know.
My guest is Philip Roth. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to an interview with Philip Roth. This week, his novel The Human Stain won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. Now, in some of your books, your surrogate, your alter ego, is the character of Nathan Zuckerman. And in your latest book, The Human Stain, the professor seeks out Zuckerman so he can tell Zuckerman his story in the hopes that Zuckerman will tell it and set the record straight. Zuckerman is also the scribe for the other two books in your trilogy. Why use him as the narrator? Why not, say, let the main character tell the story? Why not let the professor in The Human Stain just tell his story? Or why not have, like, the omniscient third-person unnamed narrator tell the story? Mm. What narrative problems do you solve by having a Zuckerman be the narrator?
Well, the biggest problem I solve is... nothing stands between me and my spontaneous reaction to the material. That is, this is not, it's not just a cunning, strategic process, you know. What you're trying to do when you write is find your freedom as a writer. It's what every writer is trying to find. Maximally deploy your powers. And I just feel this is the way I can maximally deploy my powers. By this point in my career, I should be able to spontaneously land on that voice, which will give me the most verbal freedom, imaginative freedom, and that's what Zuckerman does for me. There's something about his intelligence that awakens mine.
Zuckerman is now, I think, 67 in the latest novel. Is that right? 65.
In this book, I think he's something like 64 or 65.
Yeah, now. And he's now living as a recluse, living alone in the country and writing. He's had prostate cancer, and the surgery resulted in nerve damage that left him incontinent and unable to have sex. There's a short passage spoken by Zuckerman that I'd like you to read. It's on page 36.
Okay. I want to make clear that it wasn't impotence that led me into a reclusive existence. To the contrary, I'd already been living and writing for some 18 months in my two-room cabin up here in the Berkshires when, following a routine physical exam, I received a preliminary diagnosis of prostate cancer, and a month later, after the follow-up tests, went to Boston for the prostatectomy. My point is that by moving here, I had altered deliberately my relationship to the sexual caterwaul. And not because the exhortations, or for that matter, my erections, had been effectively weakened by time, but because I couldn't meet the costs of its clamoring anymore, could no longer marshal the wit, the strength, the patience, the illusion, the irony, the ardor, the egoism, the resilience, or the toughness, or the shrewdness, or the falseness, the dissembling, the dual being, the erotic professionalism, to deal with its array of misleading and contradictory meanings. As a result, I was able to lessen a little my postoperative shock at the prospect of permanent impotence by remembering that all the surgery had done was to make me hold to a renunciation to which I had already voluntarily submitted.
Philip Roth, I find it so interesting. You know, at the beginning of your career with Portnoy's Complaint, you became an author who became famous for writing a character who was so involved with sexual imagination and sex and very creative approaches to masturbation. And now you followed a different character, the character of Zuckerman, to a point in his life where he is physiologically unable to have sex and emotionally perhaps not that sorry about it. He's sorry. He's tired of what you describe as that erotic professionalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering why you, I realize there might not be an answer to this, but why you wanted to put him in that predicament, why you wanted to explore that kind of physiologically enforced celibacy.
Right. When I was beginning this book, or not this book, I should actually say go back to American Pastoral, because the history of Zuckerman's sexual retirement, as it were, begins in American Pastoral. At about the time I was writing that book, however many years ago it was, 5 or 6, there seemed to me to be a kind of epidemic of prostate cancer in the circle of men who I was close to. So I knew what men went through when they went through this, and I suppose it's not too remote from what women go through with various gynecological surgeries or with a mastectomy. It's a tremendous blow. It's a very, very difficult operation physically. Forget the consequences of it. And I saw this being enacted in numerous places, and I thought, well, I've reached an age where this is now a kind of phenomenon of my generation, and so I decided to take it seriously. You know, it isn't the plague, but it did seem to me a powerful blight on the sexuality and virility, needless to say, of these men I know. So that's what interested me in it to begin with. Shall I go on, Terry?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm wondering, too, if in following through on that, it made you think in a different way about a certain type of virility, a certain type of almost hyperactive male sexuality.
Well, now we're going to get into who's going to measure what.
I'm the host of the show. I'll do the measuring.
What's hyperactive down in Philadelphia, you know, may not be hyperactive in Manhattan.
Right.
I think that a blow of that kind to a virile heterosexual man is brutal. Has nothing to do with hypersexual activity, if I may say so, but to one's sexual identity and to one's sense of physical strength and completeness. It's a serious business. As for hyperactivity, to take seriously what I said jokingly a moment ago, what is hyperactivity? There are no norms. There are no sexual norms that an adult can take seriously. Just think about the history of norms and how cruel they now seem. Think of the norm of heterosexuality as opposed to homosexuality. That was a norm, was it not? And it's no longer a norm. So we don't know what the norms are. It's a very mysterious and enigmatic business, sexual activity. And that's why I've been interested in the sexual lives of men. I'm not out to titillate anybody. I'm out to try to figure out what it is, mm-hmm, and to represent it as best I can.
Now, at the same time, you explore the opposite side, which is that the 71-year-old professor in your novel is taking Viagra and having an affair with a much younger woman, and he thinks that he'd never be able to do this if it wasn't for Viagra. So he has had this kind of sexual resurgence in his 70s.
Well, Viagra seemed to me also a kind of phenomenon that a novelist ought to take seriously and not just have gags about it on late-night television. It's a gigantic social change, like a gigantic moral, the potential gigantic moral changes in the society. So like prostate cancer, the introduction of this drug in the last 5 years seemed to me to signal a gigantic change in the culture, and therefore it seems to me that's what a novelist is interested in, which is the deep influences that are at work in a country, which determine the mood of the country and determine the lives of people.
There's also a wonderful paragraph that I think I will read about the vulnerability that you expose yourself to in sexual intimacy. And this is said by the African-American professor whose passing is white, and for him the sexual act kind of exposes him to the possibility of discovery. He says, "You take off your clothes and you're in bed with somebody, and that is indeed where whatever you've concealed, your particularity, whatever it may be, however encrypted, is going to be found out. And that's what the shyness is all about and what everybody fears. In that anarchic, crazy place, how much of me is being seen? How much of me is being discovered?" I really like that a lot.
Good, good. Well, I'm delighted that you do it. I'm delighted that you read it. This book is about the things we've already talked about, to be sure, the inquisitorial spirit, the persecuting spirit, what's called political correctness, the passing, quote-unquote, of this man from one culture to another. But I also wanted to investigate and represent the power, the transforming power of sex, the transforming power of the erotic. And there's another passage, I don't think I could find it if I'm searching for it now, but when Zuckerman is recounting this sexual reawakening in the 71-year-old man, and he says, "Who could be against it?"
Philip Roth, his latest novel, The Human Stain, just won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. Our interview was recorded last year when the novel was published. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The True Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jewish Identity and Growing Up American. We continue our conversation with novelist Philip Roth, and film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Bridget Jones' Diary.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Philip Roth. This week, his novel The Human Stain won the Pen Faulkner Award for Fiction. The novel completes his trilogy about the impact of political and social events on the lives of individuals. The first, American Pastoral, is about the father of a radical activist who opposes the war in Vietnam. I Married a Communist is set in the McCarthy era. The Human Stain is about life in the age of political correctness. The three novels are narrated by Roth's fictional alter ego, Nathan Zuckerman. Two of the novels in your trilogy are about Zuckerman's boyhood heroes. I Married a Communist, the story revolves around two brothers. One of those brothers was Zuckerman's English teacher when he was in high school. The other is a working man who became a well-known radio drama star and a communist. And about Mr. Ringgold, the English teacher, Nathan Zuckerman says, Mr. Ringgold taught us thinking is the greatest transgression of all, critical thinking. There is the ultimate subversion. Seeing it demonstrated by him provided the most valuable clue to growing up that I had clutched at as a provincial, protected, high-minded high school kid, yearning to be rational and of consequence and free. Did you have such a teacher who really taught you the value of critical thinking?
I was lucky. I think I had more than one, though one is often enough. And I think that most sort of bright American kids are fortunate enough usually along the way to run into that man or woman who teaches you to think. It's kind of an amazing thing, isn't it? I fell under the influence of some people, largely in college, more in college than in high school. I don't really think I knew how to think in high school. That's, once again, Zuckerman is smarter than I was.
Zuckerman also says he really liked men who could talk about baseball and boxing, and also talk about books as if they really mattered. Did you too, when you were young, wanting to find that combination?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think for American boys, growing up as I did in the 30s and 40s, It was very hard to make the association between one's, and I use this word in its widest sense, one's virility, one's appetite, one's aggression, and learning. And it was certainly very important to make that association, because without it, learning seems sort of school-marmish, you know. So, and by the way, I grew up in an era when 95% of the teachers were women. We were little boys raised in schools that were by women. Some of them were quite wonderful teachers. Some of them were just ordinary teachers, of course. But to have a male teacher who brought a certain flavor into the classroom, who was also intellectually demanding. So when he brought the flavor of his masculinity and the sternness of his rigorous mind into the classroom, that was indeed a great blessing. And I do remember a couple such men from my high school years, excluding, say, gym teachers. That was something else.
Who were the people in your life that first exposed you to a life that was different from the life of your parents?
I suppose a couple teachers did. I think that as boys, we brought each other up. I mean, all the circle of friends one had as a kid. I think what happens is the country brings you up in a strange way. Or to put it another way, the culture brings you up. And the richer the culture, the more strains there are in the culture that aren't totally vulgar and stupid, the better educated you get in becoming something new and becoming a new generation. So one's parents give one plenty, but when you leave them, yes, you're perfectly right, you need mentors. And I would again say I think there's something in the larger society that educates you. And then there is the circle of one's friends, and you educate each other and you evolve into a new human, a new social or cultural type through this sort of effort, kind of team effort almost.
Newark, New Jersey plays a big part in your trilogy. You grew up in Newark. What was your immediate neighborhood, your immediate culture like when you were growing up?
And Well, I was born in 33, and so I guess by about 43, I was my eyes were open, and the war was on, World War II. And that was an overwhelming experience, though needless to say the war was not fought here, but the whole country was at war, and the mood of the country was determined totally by the war. And I felt that mood in our neighborhood, as everywhere else. My neighborhood was really a kind of Jewish village, I would say, in a city that was made up of ethnic villages. So the word ethnic did not exist. We never thought of ourselves that way. I think ethnic is a word that comes out of the 60s, really. I mean, it existed, but it was not a word that we used to describe ourselves. And so I never thought of myself, by the way, as an American Jew. I think of myself as an American or a Jewish American. These terms are utterly foreign to me. I never felt that anything but amused by designation. But you can call me a Newark Jew if you want to. There were Newark Italians. There were Newark Poles. There were Newark Irish. I think as kids we experience these differences locally in the city because we lived in neighborhoods that were defined in that way. And there was a certain amount of xenophobia. There was a certain amount of hostility. But once one left the neighborhood, one wasn't a Newark Jew, one was an American. So it was a Jewish neighborhood, Jewish high school, Jewish grade school, Jewish high school. Jews everywhere. Strangely, I was thinking the other day, I never saw a Jew in a skull cap on the street in my life growing up. Someone asked me about that recently. Did I wear a skullcap as a kid? I said, outrageous. I wouldn't have thought of such a thing. Nor did anybody else in the neighborhood. So here was this 100% Jewish neighborhood, and I didn't know a single soul to wear a skullcap, which tells you a lot about the fierce secularization, the fierce Americanization of my generation and my parents' generation.
We're listening back to an interview with Philip Roth. This week, his novel The Human Stain won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philip Roth. Like most novelists, he has drawn on his life for his fiction. He was written about, often in an unflattering way, in a 1996 memoir by his ex-wife, the actress Claire Bloom. But that's a subject he declines to talk about. This is a quote that you said back in 1987 that was published in U.S. News and World Report. You said, "I wouldn't want to live with a novelist. Writers are highly voyeuristic and indiscreet. But the writer should be no more ruthless with others than with himself. The same intensity of focus should be turned inward as outward." Do you feel that friends of yours have ever felt betrayed by you as a writer because you've tried to be honest? And we all have secrets. And we don't want to be honest about our secrets. We want to be secretive about our secrets.
Let me counter with an anecdote about Czeslaw Milosz, who won the Nobel Prize for Poetry, I guess, about 10 years ago. Milosz was asked a similar question. I'll tell you what he said. He was asked about, because he also writes prose and he's written memoirs and so on. He was asked about the relationship between a writer and his family and about this issue of revealing secrets and betrayal. And Milosz said, "When a writer is born into a family, the family is finished." So the defense rests.
Is that tough to live with?
For the others?
For you, the writer, who in being honest in your own way betrays the others.
I don't know if it has so much to do with being honest. You give us too much credit. I think it's just fascination. There's no novelist worth his or her salt who isn't fascinated by the real, and whose job is founded and grounded in this fascination with the real thing. There's an awful lot of stupid, childish awe in writers. People may think that you're trying to reveal their secrets. You're sort of dumbstruck by their secrets, and by your own, of course, too. And there's far less vindictiveness than is imagined on the part of the writer who writes about somebody's secret than just this sort of stupid, childish awe of the human fact of it. So it isn't so much it isn't so much that one is pious about oneself or pious about being a writer and say, well, I have to be honest. It's not that at all. It's you're hypnotized, you're mesmerized, you're fascinated by the thing in itself, and you want to present it. Now, other people may see it otherwise. They get hurt, I guess.
Are there writers who you read or who you've known who, as a young writer, gave you permission to write like yourself instead of trying to write like the people you most admired of other generations or other eras?
Sure. I have a great debt to several people. I suppose my largest debt would be to Bellow, to Saul Bellow. And I'm not alone in that, by the way. And you don't have to be Jewish to be indebted to Saul Bellow either. I suspect that half a dozen of my colleagues of my generation are a little younger, I would say, had their eyes opened to literary freedom by Bellow, particularly by a book that appeared in 1954, The Adventures of Augie March. One doesn't write like, one doesn't write like Bellow as a result. And it isn't that you then imitate this person. They provide you with a kind of example of freedom. Just as a youngster growing up may admire some other kid, some older kid, because of his or her freedom. I think we all have had that experience. Likewise with a writer, you feel not just the freedom, but the energy, and needless to say, the genius. Without the genius, none of these things mean anything. But this genius has a kind of freedom which inspires you. The opening line of Augie March is rather famous, or was then. Nothing in literature is famous any longer. But the opening line is of Bellow's book is, "I am an American Chicago born." What's interesting is that it doesn't begin, "I'm an American Jew Chicago born," or "I'm an American born a Jew in Chicago." Bellow, in a single sentence, freed a whole generation of Jewish writers who came after him to write of the thing which was so powerful in their lives, which was their Americanness. Now, that I'm just speaking just thematically of his importance. We can also speak of his verbal freedom too, which was equally inspiring.
Philip Roth is my guest. Within the past decade or a little more than that, you've had bypass surgery and also suffered a bad depression. I think for a lot of people, when you go through something that's very kind of physically life-changing, you look around at the rest of your life and figure, well, what else do I want to change? Did you make big changes in your life after that?
Let me think. I had quintuple bypass surgery back in 1989. It was kind of out of the blue, and then all I knew is I was swimming in my pool one day, and the next day I was having an operation. And I was exhilarated by the operation. First of all, they'd saved my life. Very exhilarating, that is. And I walked around exhilarated for about 6 months. And I think it re-energized me strangely. I did have a brutal depression in 7 or 8 years ago. And all you want to do is climb out of the hole, you know, and you're so content. You're in a deep hole and there are no rungs on the side to climb out with. And it's a terrible experience. It descends almost like the other thing out of the blue. And you think you'll never get out. You feel like you're in a straitjacket, except it's a mental straitjacket. And somehow you fight your way out. And after that, I think, I don't know. I don't know, Terry, if I could really say that I decided I would live differently. You've just been through the damn ringer, that's all. And you're glad to have survived. And you just want to go on. You just want to go on.
Did it leave you any more or less of a believer in either pharmaceutical therapy or talk therapy for, you know, a really brutal depression?
I don't know that talk therapy helps. It's nice to have sympathetic friends. That is a help. As far as professional talk, I don't know that if you've had the real thing that matters. The drugs are great. These Prozac and those things. They can get you out of it, and which is better than the old days. You know, 25, 30 years ago, people just sort of sat around with these things, and it was pretty grim. It's pretty grim altogether. Best not to, my advice is not to have it.
Thanks. We'll do our best. In American Pastoral, Nathan Zuckerman says about the character whose story he's telling, he had learned the worst lesson that life can teach, that it makes no sense. Do you feel that that's the lesson of life, or that that's only the lesson of life when you're going through a really bad depression?
Well, that line that you read is a telling one, to be sure, but it's not about a character who's in depression. It's about Swede Lvov after his daughter blows up a building to protest the Vietnam War.
Right.
And his life is ruined, as though she'd set the bomb off not at the local post office, but in their living room. I was talking about a life that's overtaken by what I call elsewhere the uncontrollability of real things, and I wasn't speaking then about depression.
Right. Is that, do you feel like, life's lesson, or that only some people are stuck in that predicament that life seems to make no sense?
I suppose everybody has those minutes, hours, days when it seems to make no sense. You're blessed if you can escape those feelings. I think it makes no sense, but you have to believe otherwise.
You think life makes no sense?
Not to me it doesn't, but I pretend it does.
And maybe try to give it sense in novels, or explore the no sense that it seems to have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Both.
Both.
Yes, quite seriously, both. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Philip Roth's latest novel, The Human Stain, just won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. Our interview was recorded last year when the book was published. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie adaptation of Bridget Jones' Diary. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The new movie, Bridget Jones' Diary, is based on the best-selling novel by British writer Helen Fielding. She co-wrote the screenplay. Although the film, like the novel, is set in England, it stars American actress Renee Zellweger. Henry Sheehan has a review.
Bridget Jones's Diary comes from the dark heart of contemporary English media. That's where Bridget Jones, a lowly publishing house employee, toils for career and trolls for romance. It's a world of boozy cleverness and lethal ambition, and where the roads to success in work and love intersect and overlap. Like Bridget and like author Helen Fielding, director Sharon Maguire accepts the rules of this tawdry game as immutable. A friend of Fielding and a model for one of her minor characters, Maguire is a former documentary maker who has done little more than illustrate the book with pictures of people talking. Most of that talk comes from Bridget herself, a 30-something woman whose diary is a daily record of her failures to gain control of her weight and drinking or to find a husband. Given that most of that talk involves generous dollops of self-hate, you'd imagine the movie would be a largely dismal collection of half-baked witticisms. And you'd be right, except for one thing. The vessel for all the pithy put-downs is Renee Zellweger. Somehow, someone thought that the Texas-born actress would be perfect to play the bright girl from the London suburbs. And they were right. Wearing an additional 20 pounds as if it were tailored to be chic, Zellweger transforms the brittle Bridget of the novel into a fleshy, but also flesh and blood, human. Although director Maguire doesn't handle it very well, the episodic movie does have a proper plot. Bridget is increasingly anxious to fall in love, or to put it in her own blunt terms, avoid encroaching spinsterhood. Life presents her with two romantic choices. There's her boss, the suave and charming Daniel Cleaver, played by Hugh Grant, and there's prim and taciturn Mark Darcy, played by Colin Firth. Mark's an old friend of the family who is initially put off by Bridget's compulsive, frequently embarrassing chatter. Like many contemporary wiseacres, Fielding is a sentimentalist at heart. Her jokes and jabs are the writerly equivalents of stalling till the moment when she has to reveal just what it is she values. Here's a scene between Bridget and Darcy after Bridget has had a particularly mortifying time at a fancy party.
You seem to go out of your way to try to make me feel like a complete idiot every time I see you. And you really needn't bother. I already feel like an idiot most of the time anyway.
I don't think you're an idiot at all. I mean, there are elements of the ridiculous about you. And you tend to let whatever's in your head come out of your mouth without much consideration of the consequences. What I'm trying to say, very inarticulately, is that, in fact, perhaps despite appearances, I like you very much, just as you are.
Zellweger can say any line, no matter how corny, and suffuse it with soulful melodies. It's like her line in Jerry Maguire, "You had me at hello," an overstatement that in the actress's tones became compelling. Zellweger, with her almost squeaky voice, tethers these soapy bubbles to the ground. She just may be the second coming of Jean Arthur. Zellweger is nearly matched by her co-stars, especially Grant. In Fielding's world, anyone with so much personality is bound to turn out to be a rotter, and it takes only a couple of scenes for Grant's Daniel to expose himself as such. Luckily, this is meat for the actor's grinder. The floppy-haired performer started his career playing cads, and it's always been his strong suit. Here he puts all his serpentine charm on display. Firth plays the less amusing Mark Darcy with all the underlying manliness he can muster, and it's an effective effort. The trouble comes with his character, who shares a surname with the hero of Pride and Prejudice. Once you get it in your head that Fielding is stumbling in the footsteps of Jane Austen, her story's mechanical repetitions fall apart. Even worse, while it can be said that Austen's heroine, Elizabeth Bennet, loved herself too well, Bridget Jones dislikes herself too much.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. A revival of the 1956 musical Bells Are Ringing just opened on Broadway. The music was written by Julie Stein, the lyrics by Comden and Green. The two most famous songs from the show are Just in Time and The Party's Over. From the original cast recording, here's Judy Holliday singing The Party's Over.
He's in love with Millicent Scott, a girl who doesn't exist. He's in love with someone you're not. And so remember, it was never you. Party's over, it's time to call it a day. No matter how you pretend, you knew it would end this way. It's time to wind up the masquerade. Just make your mind up, the piper must be paid. The party's over, the candles flicker and dim. You've danced and dreamed through the night. It seemed to be right, just being with him. Now you must wake up, all dreams must end. Take off your makeup, the party's over. It's all over, my friend.
Judy Holliday from the original cast recording of Bells Are Ringing. The new Broadway revival stars Faith Prince. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Nonesuch Records and soprano Dawn Upshaw's release, Angels Hide Their Faces, featuring music of Bach and Purcell. Available at Barnes & Noble music locations. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This month marks the 40th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs invasion. On the next Fresh Air, we discuss declassified Cuban and American documents that rewrite the history of the failed invasion. And we meet the CIA's Miami station chief at the time of the invasion and a Cuban exile who fought with the invading brigade. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.